the most important letter in the global economy right now. What do you think? Any guesses? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday, today the 20th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with the letter R. R for rates and R for recession. The global story on interest rates is fairly well established by now, I do believe. Central banks in most developed economies have been raising rates as they try and try to get inflation under control. Yes, the Federal Reserve skipped this past meeting, but there are more rate hikes coming. The Bank of England and the European Central Bank are raising apace. Not so, though, the People's Bank of China, which this morning cut its key rates as the second biggest economy on the planet slows just a little bit. And that, in turn, gets us to R word number two, recession, and when and whether, to be clear, one might be headed our way. But as we know, this is a global economy, and what's happening elsewhere in the world is going to affect what happens here. So in that light, Marketplace's Lily Jamali gets us going.
Here in the U.S., we really want the rest of the world to stay out of recession, says the University of Michigan's Betsy Stevenson.
That makes it really easy for us to sell the things that we are best at creating around the globe.
But all is not well around the globe. New Zealand, for starters, has slipped into a recession. That probably won't cause big impacts here at home, says CIBC's Bipin Rai.
The economy is relatively small compared to some of the other developed markets out there.
But he says some of the factors that put New Zealand in that position are familiar. Inflation and central bank efforts to beat it back by raising interest rates. Inflation's tipped Germany into recession too, says ING chief economist Karsten Brzeski.
High energy prices, high food prices have put a weight on private consumption.
Then there's the elephant in the room when it comes to global recession talk, China. Wait, is China in a recession?
We don't know, right? If you trust Chinese statistics, maybe.
George Washington University's Susan Ariel Aronson says this much about China is clear.
It is not the shiny golden object for foreign investment that it once was.
Half a year after lifting pandemic lockdowns, exports have fallen, as have prices, and unemployment among young people just hit a new record. All of that is bad news for the U.S., Aronson says.
We need each other to buy each other's goods and services.
Unlike in China, though, in economies that have tipped into recession, labor markets are still faring okay. And if those nations can recover quickly, says the University of Michigan's Betsy Stevenson,
it can help make a U.S. recession less bad.
If that much-anticipated but still elusive recession ever materializes. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, that Chinese rate cut made traders just a tad nervous. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are more new homes being built in this economy right now than there have been in a good long while. Housing starts were up more than 21% April to May. That's from the Census Bureau this morning. And starts are up almost 6% over this time last year. Given how few existing homes are for sale these days, owners perhaps reluctant to trade low for high mortgage rates, right? All this new construction should eventually help with the housing affordability problem that we have, at least in theory, more supply to meet that robust demand. Turns out, though, that much of what's being built is more high-end housing. Marketplace's Samantha Fields is on that one.
Building a new house has never been more expensive. At least that's how it seems to Clint Mitchell, who owns a building company in Indianapolis.
First, it was land prices. And then post-COVID, there's been inflation of all kind of materials and labor to build a house.
Add in high mortgage rates, and a home that might have been within reach for a first-time buyer a year or two ago just isn't anymore.
And so builders have looked to who is out there in the market and able to buy.
And he says it's mostly people who have more money and want a higher-end house. So that's what he and most builders have been building. Jenny Schutz at the Brookings Institution says to some degree that's always been the case.
New construction has always been more expensive than older existing homes.
Historically, she says,
as high-income households move into new construction, the units that they move out of filter down on the income spectrum.
But in the last decade or so, that hasn't been happening as much. New construction slowed way down during the Great Recession and still hasn't caught back up. And
because there isn't enough of the new supply, older units aren't coming down in price and filtering to lower income households as quickly as they used to.
So everything is just more expensive. In some cases, Allie Wolf at the housing data and consultancy firm Zonda says builders are building smaller homes that they initially intend to sell for less.
But then when they bring them to the market, the buyer pool is so deep that the builder is raising prices to try to match the level of demand.
A lot of local governments also have strict zoning laws and regulatory barriers that make it hard for developers to build, especially lower-cost, high-density housing, says Chris Herbert at the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard.
If we have more communities that allow for more multifamily housing, more townhouses, more small single-family houses on small lots, then I think we will see more of that housing get built.
Which, he says, could make a real difference when it comes to affordability. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Secretary of State Tony Blinken, Antony Blinken more properly, was in Beijing over the weekend having various and sundry meetings, at least one proximate goal of which was to convince President Xi Jinping and other Chinese leaders that economic competition between the two countries doesn't have to turn into confrontation. Those are Blinken's words, loosely paraphrased. But while the Biden administration is pursuing diplomatic solutions, members of Congress, Reuters is reporting this, are being a bit more brass tacks, meeting with American carmakers to urge them to move their electric vehicle supply chains, especially batteries, away from China. But as Marketplace's Elizabeth Troval reports, even with the significant investment in EV battery production that's in the Inflation Reduction Act, Chinese domination of that global battery supply chain is likely to endure for a while.
When it comes to the EV battery supply chain,
China has a 10 to 15 year head start on the rest of the world.
That's analyst Chris Berry with House Mountain Partners. He says China has invested in lithium and other battery minerals, especially
the refining of the material and then the cell and the pack production, the battery production as well.
That investment has paid off, says Scott Kennedy with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
China accounts for somewhere between, 50 to 60% of the global EV market.
They'll stay ahead even as the U.S. and Europe invest in EVs, says analyst Sam Adham of CRU. Take global lithium refining. Capacity will roughly triple by 2030. Yet,
Chinese ownership of those refining projects at the moment is around 67%. And by 2030, it's around the same.
To build its refining capacity, the U.S. will have to site, permit, and develop infrastructure, which is harder to do, says Morgan Bazillion of the Colorado School of Mines.
Communities typically don't want them in their backyard. That's the reason we have the acronym NIMBY.
But to compete with China, this infrastructure will have to be in someone's backyard. Robert Hanfield of North Carolina State University says this will likely be a regional effort.
Mexico has low-cost labor. Canada has a lot of natural resources, including lithium and copper and other minerals. And the U.S. has a lot of capital to invest in.
Hanfield calls those three countries a powerful force, but they're not going to be able to do it alone. Making electric vehicles will still require a global supply chain. I'm Elizabeth Troval for Marketplace.
While acknowledging the broad generalization I'm about to make, it is not too terribly far off base to say that working America is largely divided into two camps, blue collar and white collar. And that distinction between the two shows up now, especially, it seems, in education and income and in politics. When it comes to fashion, though, the line is more blurry. Timberland work boots and Carhartt tees and Dickies overalls have gone mainstream. And you can buy workwear at farm and ranch stores, of course, but also in Soho, in New York City, just down the street from Prada and Louis Vuitton. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looks at why workwear is so popular now for workers, from plumbers to software engineers.
Fleet Farm is a regional chain in the Midwest. And well, it's exactly what it sounds like. Animal feed, tractor parts, and hunting gear. Chris McCool is regional vice president.
Very much farm store. In fact, the stores were based off of where the most literally cows were.
Wait, they would actually like total the cow population and go from there?
Based off of the census and cows, and that's where you'd build a store.
McCool says Fleet Farm's customer base, including at this store in Monticello, Minnesota, it's mostly farmers and exurban dwellers working on home projects. But in the past few years, he's seen more people coming into the store who, well, he thinks are probably not doing a lot of manual labor.
All of the high school girls want a men's Carhartt hat in the winter.
Beanies with a Carhartt patch that come in a rainbow of colors for $19.99.
Like, it is the most popular thing, and we can't hardly keep them in stock.
McCool shuffles through some popular logo t-shirts from workwear brands.
I joke about even like the Yellowstone effect, like everybody wants to look like the Duttons.
Call it the Yellowstone effect or the hipster effect. It seems like everyone is wearing workwear, including Rihanna and former President Barack Obama. Urban Outfitters even sells Carhartt crop tops, which are maybe, probably, definitely not made for operating heavy machinery. Of course, that was the original purpose of workwear.
Throughout most of the 1800s, clothes were made for people.
Peter Liebhold is a curator emeritus at the National Museum of American History.
You didn't go to a store and just buy a ready-to-wear piece.
Even farmers and laborers had their clothes tailored. It was expensive, so they needed durable pieces like blue jeans. That's actually how we got the term blue collar. And then, during World War II, Dickies made army uniforms, and Levi's made jeans for women who stepped up to work, called Lady Levi's. That was a start to workwear going mainstream. Fast forward to the 90s, when skaters adopted it for its tough material, and hip-hop adopted it for its tough look. Sarah Crockett is the chief marketing officer at Dickies.
You often saw Snoop Dogg repping the brand. That extended into music genres and other types, like Blink-182.
Lately, Dickies is seeing more mass market interest. Walmart is now one of its biggest retail partners. And in 2019, Dickies expanded its line of everyday clothing, workwear silhouettes in lighter fabrics and brighter colors.
It's a very simple product. That means that as a blank canvas, it can be the same pant styled five different ways or for five different usage occasions, and it looks completely different.
It's one reason why Jeremy Epstein in Brooklyn, New York, is a workwear collector. He's guessing he's spent around $1,000 on Carhartt alone in the last year. His style inspiration?
Elmer Fudd, yeah. You know, he's got the hat, he's got the big boots. You know, he's kind of an icon.
Epstein used to work on Wall Street. Now he's a college professor teaching audio for film.
I'm much more of a poser than a real, you know, American truck-driving guy, you know. My hammer loop rarely has a hammer in it.
One of his favorite pieces is a Carhartt bomber jacket made of heavy black canvas. On the back is a customized silkscreen design. It reads,
Ephalent, E-P-H-A-L-E-N-T, which is how my daughter used to say elephant when she was little.
He's hoping since it's workwear, it'll last forever. In Monticello, Minnesota, I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The work that I'm doing is effortless.
Oh, do tell us the secret, wouldn't you? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 254 points, 245 actually, 245, 0.7%, 34,053. The NASDAQ down 22 points, 0.1%, 13,667. The S&P 500 down 20 points, almost 0.5%, 43 and 88. We heard from Elizabeth Trove all about the issues with making EV batteries. So looking at some of those stocks, NIO Incorporated lost 0.5%. Standard Lithium dropped 2.8% today. We heard from Kristen Schwab about the enduring appeal and popularity of workwear as worn by people not on farms or maybe on construction sites. VF Corp, which owns Dickies, Timberland, and other brands, put on 1.1% today. Duluth Holdings dressed up 0.1%. Drug maker Novo Nordisk is suing a number of medical spas, weight loss, and so-called wellness clinics. It claims they are making and selling their own versions of that company's non-insulin diabetes medications like Ozempic. You've heard of that one? Now sought after as weight loss aids, Novo Nordisk gained 0.2% today. Bond prices were up as well. The yield on the 10-year T-note down 3.72%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Climate change is an existential threat, so stipulated. But before we get that far, a warming planet is becoming an economic threat, too. Case in point, water. Too much of it. Rivers rise after heavy rains or spring snowmelt. That we know. It is normal. But floods today often carry more water and last longer. And it seems like every year, somewhere along the 2,500 or so miles of the Mississippi River, there is major flooding. That is challenging for the people in cities up and down that river in an absolute sense. But it's also a harsh dose of climate change economic reality because a lot of those cities are pouring time and money into riverfront developments that they are now having to adapt to the flooding. From St. Louis Public Radio, Eric Schmid reports.
The Mississippi River has been having a bit of a moment.
People all over the world want to come and see this iconic natural phenomenon that is the Mississippi.
That's Colin Wellenkamp, executive director of the Mississippi River Cities and Towns Initiative.
It has a larger international following than the Grand Canyon.
No longer is the Mississippi seen only as a corridor for commerce. Wellenkamp says more and more people want to interact with the river and its scenery. Things like birding, canoeing, parks, and public spaces right next to the water. Communities up and down the river are eyeing multi-million dollar developments that tap into this desire. But Wellenkamp says the cities he works with face one unavoidable problem: the Mississippi floods.
So many of my cities have seen new projects wash away.
When there's too much water, and when there's too little, those projects
get stuck in the mud because the water's way out there in the channel because it's a drought.
After major flooding in 2019, his organization started focusing more on wetlands restoration to better manage the river's water. One project is at a place called Rasky Slough, about 10 miles northeast of the St. Louis Arch. It's 60 acres of tall grasses and shallow ponds. Mike Sertle is here watching for egrets, great blue herons, and other birds.
You know you're in a wetland or near a wetland when the red wings are around.
Sertle manages Mississippi wetlands restoration projects for Ducks Unlimited. He says this slough can hold excess water during flooding and heavy rains. Water from Rasky Slough eventually flows back into the Mississippi.
The goal is to mimic a natural system. You want to dry it out every now and then because it aerates that soil and we get a flush growth of vegetation.
Plants that suck up more water and provide habitat. Sertle says from start to finish, it cost about $250,000 to restore this wetland, but bigger projects can run into the millions.
Investment in proper infrastructure in these wetland systems, as we look years of return, we are seeing that it's worth the upfront cost.
And the thing is, wetlands have already been effective this year to stem flooding from rapid spring snowmelt on the upper Mississippi.
For us, this flood, third highest on record for the city of La Crosse, was proof of concept.
Mitch Reynolds is the mayor of La Crosse, Wisconsin. He says his city managed to avoid major damage with the help of wetlands. New pumps helped move floodwaters from lower areas into nearby natural habitat.
We're lucky enough to have a marsh in the midst of the city that is our floodwater storage.
Reynolds says he and other mayors along the Mississippi are leaning into the idea of having nature work for them. It reduces some of the risk that's inherent with building right on the riverfront. Plus, Colin Wellenkamp says the banks that offer loans on these projects are also paying attention. Some have even given better interest rates on developments that preserve existing wetlands.
Because the wetland creates a natural buffer to protect what we're buying, what we're paying for.
He says there's less to worry about when the water starts to rise, and more places to experience the natural river. In St. Louis, I'm Eric Schmid for Marketplace.
Sometimes you just want to do something else. We've certainly seen that through the pandemic, people changing jobs for a whole lot of reasons. But changing careers after building one over decades can be daunting. In a way, it's kind of like starting all over again. And that is where we start with this week's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Genevieve Leonard. I currently live in northern New Jersey in the great town of Cranford, and I recently decided to leave my 20-year career in education in order to pursue a full-time career as a working artist in the film and television industry.
So I first got into education as a vehicle of necessity, but working as an educator was never my end game. Even though I was good at it, in my off hours, I was really struggling. And I kind of put my foot down. I said, look, it's now or never. So when I decided to take off from education, I didn't have another job lined up because one of the requirements in a creative industry is to have a competitive portfolio. So the kind of work I was producing never really elevated beyond those foundation skills. But considering how long I've been out of school, I really felt it was important to work on a portfolio that showed more intermediate and advanced skills. So back in May 2022 was the last class that I taught, and I spent last summer picking fun projects that I wanted to do and made a list and started working on them. And I have been doing it nonstop for 6 months. So a few months ago, I actually participated in a free online workshop by a nonprofit organization called Access VFX. And it invited studio artists who volunteered their time, looked at a variety of different portfolios, and gave them feedback. In this setting, it's really helpful to have that face time with another artist, especially somebody who's experienced, and they can tell me, oh, okay, this is the state of your reel. So talking to another professional is definitely good in helping me kind of up my skills. When I'm working on any creative project, even if it's a project for a client, I reach this state of flow where I feel like all of the skill set that I was trained in that's kind of locked in the back of my brain is now finally being used. And I kind of feel the gears moving and churning. And the work that I'm doing is effortless. And the act of that being effortless, even when I'm working 40 hours a week on my portfolio, and at times it can be stressful, at the end of the day, when I see what I've done, I feel so satisfied and I feel purposeful and it feels rewarding.
Genevieve Leonard, artist in the great town of Cranford, New Jersey. I have said it before, I will say it again. This economy and this series do not happen without stories like yours. So tell us, would you? Marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, kind of an addendum to Elizabeth Trovall's piece on EV batteries. General Motors announced a couple of weeks ago, you might remember this, it's going to partner up with Tesla to make GM cars compatible with Tesla's charging system. Today, it's Rivian, the somewhat troubled EV, SUV, and truck maker that is lining up with Elon Musk's car company. Ford is already on board, and you can kind of see where this is going, right?
We'll be right back.
All right, we're going, but here is your moment of economic context, which comes with a reminder that it is really important to pay off your credit card balance every month if you can. Saw this on CNBC. The data is from Bankrate.com, but the average credit card in this economy right now is charging an annual percentage rate of more than 20%. 20%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Kerry Barber, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.